Could I have the first image, please? Contemporary architecture has been invested in exploring the potentials of the flexibilization of form, the ways in which building, urban and landscape forms could be designed to accommodate and express changes in scale, function, shape, or identity over time. I will focus my presentation on the different directions that this pursuit has taken in contemporary architecture and how these could relate to changes in land use, working and living conditions, and the attitude towards public life. I will then outline parallel critiques of flexibilization from the social sciences and from design, and conclude by proposing that the perseverance in the pursuit of flexibility by contemporary architecture is generating rich responses to the social changes this panel is studying. To be sure, the preoccupation with flexibility has other motivations and origins. The renewed interest in the architecture of the 1950s and 60s may have carried with it some of the concerns of that period, flexibility being one of them. I mentioned in passing the proliferation of dissertations on topics like Archizum, plug-in cities, and the non-plan movement in England. Some of this preoccupation with flexibility is also linked to the possibilities that new technology is offering to design, both construction technology, for example, just the simple idea that glass now can change opacity with light, and representation and production technologies, for example, the fact that computer technologies now in software can help us describe the fluid shapes and amorphous shapes of buildings like those by Frank Gehry, but also help us build them. Within the framework of this presentation, however, I will address the genealogical and technological motivations only insofar as they reflect on the formal and social issues I have mentioned. Let me start with four simple examples of how the pursuit of flexibilization manifests itself in architecture. The first example is the idea of expandability, the idea that form could expand to accommodate the growth of institutions in urban areas. Form changes inside. And here I just cite two examples. One is the renewed interest in what is known as carpet housing or mat housing, the slide on the left. The idea that there's a heavy investment in the design of the unit, the monad or the cell, and how it could multiply and fit within amorphous areas, but also anticipate its change in growth over time. But also the fact that many of the institutions, particularly cultural institutions in cities, and I'm using the slide of MoMA to illustrate that, are constantly facing the challenge to expand while maintaining their identity. There's MoMA, but there's also Guggenheim and Whitney. The other example is the idea of versatility, the idea that forms could be designed in such a way as to allow for a variety of possible uses to occur within the same space. In other words, that form changes function. And here I'm using the recent example of the Dutch firm's MVRDV entry to Leal in Paris, the competition, which did not win. But the space itself, and this is very significant that this idea of versatility is taken to the definition of open space, the space is designed in such a way, the ground of it, to accommodate for possibility of different landscapes changing with season and with events. Third example is from the idea of convertibility, the idea that buildings or spaces could be physically transformed to accommodate for needs to change size, shape, or opacity. And in this condition, form changes shape. I just bring in again two examples, one which is from a kinetic interpretation of this idea coming from people like Wes Jones, the image on the top, where Wes Jones always evokes industry and the machinery with the parts of the building that change in order to accommodate for changes in opacity, changes in function and size, even in rooms. But also this example by French-German team, LAPFAC, where what is understood to be the most flexible of spaces, which is the grid, is taken to another extreme, taken another step by making the columns themselves movable in order to accommodate for a variety of sizes of functions within it. And lastly, as an example, the idea of fluidity, that the identity and components of a form, its gestalt, could also change over time in order to accommodate changes in context and function. And in this case, form changes identity. I am bringing in the example of the Highline project by Diller Scofidio with James Corner. And if the text is legible, you can see the use of the term flexibility in reference to an idea that they bring in called what they call agri-texture, the idea that the architecture now follows the cycles of agriculture, that planting changes over time, and that the architecture space and the functions within it change over time. These formal explorations are no doubt inspired by some of the issues already discussed in terms of the impact of changes in labor patterns on the urban scale. I mentioned such well-studied phenomena, and they have been discussed already by Dieter and Susan, as the adoption of less stringent land use subdivisions to allow for mixing of work and living, the creation of new business centers on urban fringes, the continuous expansion of culture and educational institutions in cities, the increasing collaborations between public and private associations to creatively address the increasing complexity of urban space management that Jerry Frug mentioned earlier, especially as private job providers become more powerful but also more invested in the competition among cities, and the emergence of intense intermodal nodes that link the expanding networks, the ever-expanding networks of transportation in ever-growing cities. And I think the panel on transportation will probably address that. I want to find other links between these social changes and the investment in flexibilization and architecture. But before I go there, and I will do that by way of social critiques of the notion of flexibilization, we should not forget that what we do as designers is also work, labor, and hard work sometimes, and that our labor is also undergoing similar changes to the ones that have been outlined by Dieter. New areas of specialization and flexible networks of association among specialists. You should have seen the list of credits on the Highline project from very different backgrounds. There are also divisions of labor in design and building process that in some ways correspond to the divisions of labor designers between workers from the developed world and developing world. But let me go through the route of the social critique of flexibilization. In the second industrial divide, Peore and Sable detected that in order to accommodate for constant change, industry and society were moving back to a form of flexible specialization that was characteristic of traditional craft. This form of specialization, they argued, has been enabled by the computer and the emergence of niche markets and is requiring a transformation in the nature and organization of labor and an increase of cooperation among competitors. Accordingly, many business models today also rely on the concept of flexibility as the main guarantee of organizational and competitive success. Some social scientists have cautioned against the uncritical embrace of this contemporary condition. Among them, at least three are present here, Dieter Lapel, Saskia Sassen, Richard Sennett. Because they are here, I will not talk about their ideas. Instead, I will talk about a fourth person who is not here. German sociologist Ulrich Beck argues that flexibilization is occurring at the level of structure of work, place of work, and work time, and is an attempt to mediate between individual tracks of life in an increasingly complex global structure. Beck describes the structure as risk society, a society constantly confronted with the dangers of self-elimination. Until the advent of nuclear warfare, no human act could threaten to annihilate humanity. Since then, however, and with rapid advances in technology, several hazards have multiplied this risk, be they nuclear, ecological, or genetic. In its first phase, risk society does not fully understand the complexity of the technologies that run it. It blames technology for having produced the hazards, but then immediately delegates to the technologists themselves the responsibility of dealing with these hazards. This could be one of the reasons behind the embrace of high-tech architecture today, particularly as a sign of commitment to environment, one of those main hazards. And if we can just notice the transition in the use of technology in the work of someone like Renzo Piano, where in the 70s, the technology was a kind of do-it-yourself R2D2 approach, and then the later approach is definitely about making it look slick, obscure, distant, but a kind of guarantee that it is complex and someone is taking care of the complexities of environment and function inside. Flexibilization is understood here as another coping mechanism in risk society. It is a quality that many seek as if to guarantee that these large, complex, and incomprehensible structures that govern our lives accommodate individual needs and local positions. Flexibility is one of the means by which today's society tries to handle the inability to fit the local in the global and to effectively mobilize and coordinate among individual actions. Richard Sennett has added another worrisome ramification, the inability of flexible forms of organization to provide long-term security guarantees for the worker, but also of recognition or respect. If we are to link the current fascination with flexibility in architecture with a parallel one in the 50s and 60s, we should also mention the critiques of flexibility launched in the early 60s. Aldo Rossi and the neo-rationalists in Italy argued that modern functionalism did not fulfill the promise of flexibility. Instead, Rossi proposed that traditional urban forms were more flexible, more capable of adapting to change of use and identity over time. In a parallel critique, the American architect Robert Venturi put forward his famous both-and idea in architecture, arguing against the exclusionary Puritanism of high modern architecture, against the possibility that buildings should be tailor-made to fit their functions. Venturi favored multifunctioning spaces. He says the multifunctioning room is possibly a truer answer to modern architects' concern with flexibility. The room with a generic rather than a specific purpose and with movable furniture rather than movable partitions promotes a perceptual flexibility rather than a physical flexibility and permits the toughness and permanence still necessary in our building. He concludes, valid ambiguity promotes useful flexibility. Unlike these postmodern critiques of Rossi and Venturi, contemporary architects are not abandoning their entire exploration in face of the first hurdles in front of their explorations and returning to old proven models. They are persevering from within. They're also moving away from the metaphoric expression of flexibility that has guided some of the explorations to focus more on the physical means for its social realization. In doing so, they are also discovering that fixed forms may be expressive of social change, but very different than the ones that Rossi and Venturi have promoted. I just want to give three examples of such explorations. The first one is an ongoing search in contemporary architecture for new underlying armatures that allow for this flexibility to occur. The grid may have been the original model of such structures, and Kohlhaas' analysis of the New York grid is the example for that. But contemporary architects are also uncovering different types of grids and armatures with different degrees of propensity. This is the grid underlying the Labfac building, and we can see different scales of column spacing, different heights, and the intermeshing between them that could produce different possibilities of usage. Second, a search for very highly articulated building components that allow for different interpretations of their occupation to occur without dictating uses too closely. I give just as an example to the categories that architects like FOA are developing. Alejandro is still not here. Okay, there's a way to prompt him. Such as what they refer to as continuous roofs, discontinuous grounds. In short, their attempt to define highly charged and overdetermined surfaces that help inspire the uses of the underdetermined spaces they contain. This is the Yokohama terminal. And third example is the idea of exploring the potential of emptiness in architecture. And these are the open spaces that the Highline competition entry by James Corner and Dillard Scofidio provide. Unusually empty spaces for the kind of thematized public space approach that has dominated most of the competitions today. Sociologist Isaac Joseph, who's also not here, has distinguished between full and empty spaces. In his argument, full spaces are architecturally or programmatically full and prescribe the way they are to be used and received by their users. Empty spaces, on the other hand, are those void of architectural signification, but are nevertheless charged with possibilities of social occupation and perhaps signification. Now, this is not at all a call for the abandonment of architecture. To the contrary, making architecture disappear requires very sophisticated architectural skills. But I would argue that this has become one of the stronger currents in the work of architects like Corner and Stan Allen, and one of the tendencies in landscape urbanism as well. It may be too early and even too limiting to suggest that these explorations are converging into a singular new direction. But for the sake of pushing the exploration forward, even if a bit ahead of itself, I want to suggest that we may be witnessing a shift of gear from a pursuit of physical flexibility that represents change to a search for formal qualities that inspire change without imposing it. Again, the kind of resilience found in the propensity of armatures such as grids, intensities of surfaces, and suggestive voids. Our risk society, Beck proposes, will soon come around to realize that much of the technological cures it has developed for its technological errors are inadequate. In its second stage, risk society will also realize that its own social logics and complexities need to be made more accessible to the members of society in order for it to become readily transformable by them. I would like to think of the new outputs in architectural research as a step in that direction.